reorganize and, get things kind of off on the right foot, which it needed to be done anyway, but at the time I didn't know it. So that was in 2008 when we got started. We got everything kind of finally on the right track, probably in 2013 or 14. After all that, what's weird is I really didn't start taking business growth and development serious until 2018 or 19. It took 10 years for me to start doing that. You know, I was just always out chasing money. And I'm sure you talk to a lot of guys, and if you've been in the home improvement business very long, you see a lot of guys go under, or you see people in all these groups, these neighborhood groups, you know, they have the contractors, they show up, they draw up some money, they get started, they do some work, they draw up some more money, and they never hear from them. A lot of times that is not because those contractors are bad people, but it's because they are perpetually tangled up in the money train, right? They don't know how to.
The Blue Collar Voices Show.
The answer to the last trivia question is the General Noble Tree, a giant sequoia from the Converse Basin Grove in the Sierra Mountains of California, USA. Contemporary reports suggest it stood 285 feet tall and had a diameter of 19 feet 6 inches at a height of 52 feet off the ground at which the cut was made, with the aid of a specially built scaffolding tower. Though at the base, this increased to a diameter of 26 feet and a circumference of 81.5 feet. General Noble's total volume is estimated to have been around 44,140 cubic feet, according to big tree hunter Wendell Flint. It was felled in August 1982.
No, Marty. Both you and Jennifer turn out fine. It's your kids, Marty. Something has got to be done about your kids.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Howdy, guys. Welcome to the Blue Collar Voices Show. Our guest today is with Billy Klein. Billy is from my neck of the woods in Dallas-Fort Worth area. I found Billy in one of the groups I'm in on Facebook. He was sharing a success story and it stood out. To be honest, at this time, I don't remember exactly what it was. I checked out Billy's profile quickly and then I asked him to be on the podcast. It's taken some time to get sorted out and able to meet for this, but here we are. Billy runs a door company in DFW called DFW Door Repair. I was significantly impressed with the growth and reach that Billy has established in the DFW area. I read recently that he is expanding in a unique way, and I'll let him talk about that later. As always, the conversation is free-flowing, and we just see where it takes us. Billy, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices Show.
Thanks for having me on.
I do appreciate you being here. I'm grateful for every guest I get.
I am grateful for the opportunity.
Well, absolutely. The first short question is, what year did you start your business?
Oh my goodness, that's a pretty loaded question for me. I've always been an entrepreneur at heart.
Let's go with the door business that you currently have.
The business I currently have, we incorporated in 2009, I believe.
Before you incorporated, were you still doing something similar?
Yep. Always been kind of hustling in the home improvement space, remodeling, kitchen and bath, did a lot of that. Started kind of focusing on doors in 2007 or 8, made a pretty good living, did installations for Home Depot for a couple years. That was pretty good money for a kid, 20-something-year-old kid making 100 grand a year doing door install, you know, but it was a hustle, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem was they didn't have their things together and still really don't. It was always problems, always a mess, always a reason why you couldn't get something done. And customers were always mad when you showed up because the store had already done something to make them mad, you know, or dropped the ball. And it just got to where it was not that much fun.
If you had to summarize what it is you do today with your company, what would be the heart, the succinctness of what you do?
I tell my people that what we provide is an exceptional customer service journey and experience. We happen to do that through the widget of doors. Doors is our expertise. How we try and get that in the home is through our exceptional customer service journey.
I like that. So from 2000, go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, I think the customer service is really the best way to deliver a value to a commoditized market. We're kind of fortunate that there's not a lot of people competing for what we do, like heating, air, and plumbing. You know, those guys really have to stand out. We get the opportunity to stand out earlier on in the process, but it's that customer service experience and journey that we really want to knock out of the park. So they will refer us to their friends, call us back when they need us, get that review. That's the lifeblood now of so many home service companies. You really have to hit that out of the park for people to be memorable. People long forget what you did, but they'll always remember how you make them feel.
True. Do you do more of, and you just tell me your ratio, of door repairs or new door installations?
If you'd asked me that last week, I would have sworn that we do way more repairs, but we actually did an audit year to date this year, and it's almost even, but 55% of our revenue was generated from replacements, and 45% to this point in the year has been done through repairs. Way more tickets in repairs than replacement, but revenue-wise, it was 55 in replacement and 45 in repairs, but it takes a lot more tickets to make that amount.
Two follow-up questions. What's your most common repair call, and what's the most common reason for replacing a door?
So the most common repair call is probably a rotted door frame. The rotted door recalls turn into replacements a lot of times because in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, the builders all use steel doors, right, for their back and patio doors, and a lot of times the entry doors too. But the problem with the steel door is they still have a wood edge and a wood bottom. Of course, the door frames are all exposed and they always rot. But what happens is the water and the rot starts to get into the edge of the door and the door rots. So it's probably our biggest request is a rotted door repair.
Okay.
Most of those turn into replacement calls because the doors are too far gone to repair.
If somebody just has a door, it's a functional door, and they just want to upgrade it, how much of that market do you see?
We get a fair amount of those calls. We're actually working on our reporting in our CRM this week to be set up better to better assess that, you know, to find out what percentage of our calls are people that call in straight away that just want a new door or want an upgrade or, you know, specifically a new front door. Generally speaking, front doors are a better, bigger ticket item, good margins for us, but not necessarily the only type of door to replace. Challenge that we run into with replacing entry doors is that they're like people, right? They almost have a personality. Your home has a personality or a style or a look or a feel. And that gets combined with the personality of the people that live there. And when you try and marry those together, the options are almost infinite. A lot of times we have to back into it by trying to decide or figure out a budget, because you can spend $4,000 for a new front door, or you can spend $30,000 depending on your home, the value of your home. There's a lot of variables that go into that. Trying to balance that out for the individual based off the value of their home, their personality, their tastes, balance that with curb appeal can be kind of tricky sometimes.
I admit, I really love entry doors, and you just see some of those doors and they're just phenomenal. And some of them, not so much. Yeah. But you see some that are, I guess I really like some that almost have a callback to some medieval touches. And you're like, it's a new door, but it is just exquisite. And it seems like those are always more costly.
We do a lot of those. We do a lot of neat stuff. We make a lot of round and radius top stuff. I have a full custom millwork shop in our facility where people call us up. They can't get this thing, this type of door anywhere else. They call us up. We go out and measure it up and do drawings and make radiuses, twin units, quad units, units with 16-foot tall transoms, all kinds of cool stuff.
That makes me think you might go in a situation and have to completely remove and somewhat reframe a wall to allow a larger door.
We do that on occasion. A lot of times people will have just a regular door, and then the builders will put these two little 10-inch wide or even one bricked-in window that goes down about 70% of the door's height, and then there's brick under it, and people want to open that up a lot of times and do a double door or a, mm-hmm. a full door unit with a side light built into it so it all matches, and we do a lot of those. Yep.
What about oversized doors? Like you got an entry where it's almost two stories when you first go in, and then you put a really nice large door in there. Have you ever upgraded that type of situation?
We do that a lot. Yeah, a lot of times someone will have just a regular window above the door, and we'll go in and we'll build a unit that's got the transom window as part of the unit where it all matches. You know, you've got the mahogany extends well above the top of the door with a sash and a certain type of glass in it that makes it really unique, custom, and beautiful, and fits the person's budget and the style of their home.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yep, it's a lot of fun.
So how did you, let's just go back to child, did you have any exposure to construction and trades when you were a kid?
I did, yeah. My dad and my granddad built houses, framed houses, remodeled houses. We're always pretty self-sufficient around our household. My dad was always adding on to the house or changing things or doing things. You know, he was always relatively self-sufficient, handy people, most likely spawned from a life or growing up of just making do with what you had and not calling someone. You know, if you needed help with something, you just figured it out, right? You needed something done, you know, you figured out how to change the switch or whatever. Early on, my granddad had a remodeling company and construction company. They framed a lot of houses in the 60s and 70s around Dallas and just wherever they went, you know, they just figured out how to make a living off of home improvement type stuff, construction type stuff. My dad actually and my granddad started I don't know what you call it, I guess. They had dozers and backhoes. They would install septic systems, build house pads, clear land, stuff like that. So we were always exposed to an entrepreneurial mindset. I'll expand on that later, but maybe less of an entrepreneurial mindset, but just to go out and get stuff done and hustle and create your own living in life, if that makes sense.
Sure. And not regimented to one little tiny segment either.
Yeah, I think that was probably their downfall. Bigger picture, looking back, they were always willing to do anything to make a buck and never really focused in one area for very long. And I think looking back across that, had they may have found larger success. We always did fine, you know, don't get me wrong, but it was never a knock it out of the park type business. It was just always just making a good living.
In their particular area and in that time of life and that culture and society, would it have been possible to focus and drill down that much?
It would have been tough because I'm pretty well plugged in with a lot of big companies now and the way they market and things like that. Marketing and advertising has changed so much. Back in the 80s and 90s, it would have probably been pretty tough to scale without doing TV or radio, mostly TV if I had to guess, because we didn't have email marketing, wasn't really that big of a thing. Online advertising and all these digital assets that we have at our fingertips now for marketing and efficiency and marketing and things like that they didn't have. Mostly word of mouth, handing out their business cards. Door to door was a really big thing back then that they didn't do. Mm-hmm. So it would have been hard for them to scale very much back then without having that approach or aspect of marketing.
Instead of scaling, What about niching down? Let's say they wanted to be specifically focused on, say, septic. Would there have been enough business just to do septic?
Yeah, I think so. My aunt and her husband worked with them for a long time back in the 90s and early 2000s doing just that. When they all kind of went their own separate ways or got into other things, he focused on that and has got a very profitable, very nice size dirt work and septic business there now to this day in the same market.
All right. So you had that exposure when you were young, and then moving forwards, let's say you graduated high school, what did you do?
So when I graduated high school, the only real job I ever had was at Walmart for about 6 weeks. And I said, when I say a real job, I mean a W-2 job at the time. I joined the military when I was a junior in high school. They had this thing called a split option training where they would let us go to boot camp after our junior year in the summer, come back, finish our senior year, and then go do the rest of our training after we graduate our senior year. And I joined the Arkansas National Guard, and that was the training program that I did. It was pretty cool. It brought a lot of structure to a young person who didn't really have any, discipline type structure that the military provides. I had a great family and a great upbringing, worked a lot. But looking back, I literally joined the military so I could get off the farm and didn't have to pick blueberries. You know, we had a blueberry farm too, you know.
Okay.
That was
hard work.
It was hard work. Yep. We chopped wood and burned wood for fuel, you know, in the winter, just always developing parcels of land and cleaning up the blueberries, getting ready for the crops and all the things, picking berries, you know, all the things that go along with that. And I thought that I was getting away from all that, but looking back, probably wouldn't have had any of the momentum that we've got now if it wasn't for my dad instilling that work ethic in me at an early age.
Absolutely. What part of the country were you in?
We were in Northwest Arkansas near Fayetteville, Arkansas.
So after you got back from basic training, you started the next year at school. How did that feel? How did your worldview, because it makes a difference. So what was your experience there?
Yeah, I was exposed to a lot of things that I had never been exposed to culturally. They throw you in a platoon with 40 or 50 other people from all walks of life. Colors, creeds, nations, you know, everybody is just thrown in there and you all kind of figure out how to work together, how to solve problems together, how to live together. And it was something I'd really never been exposed to in my own little small piece of the world that we grew up in. Honestly, my senior year of high school, my life was really easy at that point because physically, it helped me develop physically to a point where sports were easy for me. I had some opportunities for further opportunities after high school to play basketball. I decided not to do that. It's interesting, you know, in retrospect, that it really brought some, what's the word? Organization, I guess, is a pretty good word to my life in the sense that it was easier for me to have vision into things and decide how to approach those versus some order, I guess is a better word than organization, some order. It was certainly visible to me and those people that I was around that I had matured and had a lot of just a better head on my shoulders, I guess, than my peers at the time coming out of my senior year. A little bit of focus, a little bit of direction and things like that that a lot of people aren't necessarily privileged to find until later in their life.
Absolutely. So you got out of high school. What'd you do next?
So I got out of high school, and like a lot of young people do, I had a high school sweetheart who I was in love with. I went to work for her dad as a logger. A lot of small mom and pop businesses pay their people through 1099 and self-employ and all the things. And there I go. I went and bought a chainsaw and was thrown onto a skidder, and I was a logger. And that lasted for probably a year or so. I really enjoyed it. It was hot, hard work, cold in the winter, hot in the summer, very dangerous. I actually had a tree fall on me and break my leg.
Ouch.
Yeah. And that pretty much ended my logging career. I just decided that trading my time for money in such a dangerous occupation really didn't have a lot of future in it. the only people who really got wealthy in the logging industry are the sawmills. And I had early on had an eye for trying to figure out where the top of the food chain was. Even though I didn't understand how to get there, I decided that putting my life at risk in exchange for a living wasn't where I wanted to be.
How bad was the leg?
It really wasn't that bad to start with. What happened was I was standing on a pile of logs. We called it a buck pile. Like the skidder would bring in 7 or 8 trees at a time and would continue to pile these trees on top of one another next to the loader where we would load them on the trucks. It was my job at the time to stand on top of the pile to measure the trees, to cut them to the length so they could be loaded on the truck. And I cut one of the logs that wasn't the right length. I cut it off. And when I did, the whole pile shifted. I had enough, I guess, vision at the time to throw my saw down and jump off the pile. I didn't quite jump far enough. And when the log started rolling off the pile, one of the logs had just kind of rolled up onto my leg. And it was just luckily within reach of the loader to where the guy on the loader could reach the log and pull it off my leg. It didn't necessarily break it at the time, and I thought I was okay. You know, I went home for the rest of the day and rested and thought I was okay. But the next day, I was just walking in my leg. I felt it snap, so it had obviously fractured it to a point to where it wasn't just necessarily broken. But once it snapped, it was obvious that it was broken. So
that's about the best case scenario, isn't it?
Yeah, it could have been a lot worse. You know, sure. I could have been killed or crushed or handicapped forever.
100%. So you said enough of that?
That was it. I decided that was it for me. I just kind of bounced around doing remodeling and odd jobs, and I went to work for this fellow who was a roofer. I crawled up on roofs. We tore off roofs. We installed roofs. He taught me how to do roofing. I did that for a while. I didn't realize at the time I was kind of afraid of heights. You know, like in Arkansas, a lot of houses have basements and they're on steep hills. So in the front of the house, it would be 1 or 2 story. It didn't really seem that bad. But when you get on the back of the house and look down, it's 20, 30, 40 foot down. That didn't appeal to me very much, and had another close call there. We would build what we call toe boards, which is basically a 2x4. These toe boards would be every 6 or so foot from the edge of the roof up, and however long the 2x4 was, 8 foot, 10 foot, 12 foot, we would put these toe boards on. Well, one day we were on the backside of this roof, and one of the young guys I was working with was carrying the shingles up the roof from a point to where we didn't need them anymore, just getting them higher up and out of the way. And he had stacked too many bundles of shingles on one of these toe boards. And the tow board broke. Well, all the shingles on this tow board start racing down the roof fast as they can. And every time they would hit a tow board, the speed and velocity and the weight of the shingles would break the tow board. I got really lucky that I was standing on the last tow board and I saw it coming, but I was close to a valley and there was an air hose there. And I grabbed the air hose and got in the valley, and I was able to stop myself before I went off the roof as these tow boards broke. So I got pretty lucky there. And I did that for about 1.5 years and realized that roofing was another good thing to know and learn, but it was another one of those things where the roofer's not at the top of the proverbial financial food chain. And I decided that it wasn't worth risking my life for making a living that way.
Right.
And I did framing and most various aspects of construction and residential construction and home improvement up to that point. I decided that I liked remodeling a lot better. Had the opportunity through a few remodeling jobs to install some doors and stuff at that time. And I enjoyed that, but I didn't realize there was a living to be made or had just strictly through doors. We installed a lot of doors and windows and things like that. It was relatively simple. I understood it. Put it in square and plumb level and make sure it doesn't leak and you're in good shape. So you just have to do that a whole lot over and over and over again to be able to make very much money at that. But I didn't realize that was a thing at the time, but boy, am I glad I did.
Tell me about the transition. You're doing these odd jobs and working with the doors.
Yeah. So I got married in 2002 to a girl from where I was from. She had just graduated college and wanted to be a chiropractor. So we were going to move to Dallas so she could become a chiropractor. And she enrolled in the Parker College of Chiropractic in Dallas. And when we got to Dallas, I didn't know anybody. You know, I had some family generally in the area. Didn't know anybody, didn't know where to start. In Arkansas, new construction, you can make a fairly decent hourly wage doing just about anything in new construction in Arkansas. But when I moved to Dallas, the demographic was totally different. There was lots of new construction going on, you know, lots of houses being built, thousands at a time. Wasn't necessarily that hard to find a place to go and try and find work. But the demographic was such that the wages were much lower. Most of the people doing new construction in Dallas, English is not their first language. So
that is true.
And at that time, in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, if you were a builder, you didn't necessarily put a lot of care on where your labor came from, and you were just mostly looking for the guy who would do it for less and the fastest. I couldn't compete with the guys that were doing it for the less and the fastest, right? And I couldn't necessarily communicate with them very well. I did, however, eventually learn how to speak Spanish, but those guys were, you just couldn't compete with them and make a living. There was more of them. They worked harder. They worked faster. They worked longer. They would make up for the wage and time by working longer and doing more overtime and also pooling their resources together. And it just wasn't something that I was interested in doing, bigger picture. Back then, this was 2002 or 2003. So when you needed a job, you know, you go to the newspaper, right? To the classifieds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I found a guy in the classifieds who was looking for trim carpenters, and I'd had a fair amount of Finnish and trim carpenter experience. So I answered the ad, and come to find out this guy had a contract with a handful of Home Depots doing all their door installations. Called him up. He met me one day on one side of the Metroplex, gave me a door and an address, and said, go put it in. We'll see how you do. But literally met this guy on the side of the road for the first time. He put this door in my truck, and I went out, installed this patio door, took out a sliding door and put in this patio door. Of course, I'd already done that a few times in my life. Did a good job, cleaned up. Growing up in a small town, manners was always something that our parents would, of course, make sure, yes, sir, no, sir, all the things. So didn't realize at the time, of course, when you're a kid, you're not necessarily interested in doing those things. But when you get older, you realize how important those are when you're, you know, in a social or networking environment or trying to get a job. Most people really appreciate good manners. So
sure,
that all really built the profile of the person that I was becoming in business, and, you know, did a good job for him, and he kept giving me work, and I turned into one of his better installers at the time, 22, 23 years old, and making pretty good money. I'd go out and make $400, $500, $600 in a day. And back then, $600 was worth $600 now, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
It was really good, and I enjoyed it. It wasn't too hard on me. I could make as much money as however hard I wanted to work. If I wanted to work Saturdays and Sundays and make that extra money, I could. So it was interesting, you know. But of course, all good things come to an end. Home Depot was certainly not real squared away. They were consolidating. Companies were coming in. Home Depot was more interested in working with one company over large territories, 4 or 5 stores per company. They were struggling to maintain control in a uniform project by having fractional installers and not being all under one umbrella. So they went to a larger format, larger company. Of course, when that happens, when corporate gets involved, they lose touch with the customers. They lose kind of touch.
Personal touch.
Yeah, all those things. And it winds up becoming a lot less organized. A lot more processes need to be involved. And ultimately, in my opinion, what happens is too many people are between the customer and the installer, which are two of the three most important aspects of the whole experience for the customer, right? And when you get 4 different stops with people taking money out all the way and changing the way things are done all the way, by the time the installer or I would get to the customer's home, they were already upset because, you know, somebody had already broken the process well before I got there. They were already upset, and it just made it a lot harder for the installer to do a job that wasn't just looked over from top to bottom and they're already had all these problem experiences, so they expect the same thing from the installation. So it was made it a challenge to live up or to exceed the customer's expectations. But it also, looking back, helped me to develop a sense of customer service that is very important in my business and to me today, because without having to do that back then, it may have taken me a while to develop that.
So you're still working for this guy and you're doing the work from Home Depot through this guy. Exactly how did you transition over to doing work for yourself?
Like a lot of guys in the early 2000s, everything, it's kind of interesting looking back how technology has evolved, how we do every aspect, right? Of course, back then, who would have heard of a podcast, right? Or
exactly.
Even YouTube. But now they're as common as the mailman.
More common.
Yeah. It's just how we live now. I'll segue into that in a little bit. I had gotten away from the Home Depot thing. It just got to be too many headaches. They never had things right. You know, a lot of the work turned to special order. They were selling a lot of things that they didn't keep in stock. And 90% of the time when they special ordered something, it either come in wrong, come in damaged, or some other issue. Not all the things that were ordered were in. So they always compensated us for that, but I would have rather made the $400 to do the install than the $60 to not get to work, right? So it just got to be cost prohibitive for me. So I developed a fairly strong clientele of people that would ask me to do other things. And back then, I was always willing to work on a Saturday to go and tile some floor or to repair some soffit or fascia or something like that. So I always had people who were asking me to do these other things, and I always would. So I just decided that I was going to start doing that on my own. And I stayed busy enough, made enough to make a living, and was ultimately trying to develop my business and what I thought was my business at the time. What happens to a lot of people is they're pretty good at doing the thing, right? You're a good technician, a good installer, good at sales. But most businesses are a minimum of three-legged stool, right? Sales, fulfillment, and marketing. I was good at two of those, but the third one I had no clue about. So what happens is you eventually dry up, don't get enough leads, or you sell more than you can get to, or whatever. You don't charge enough. So ultimately that happened to me. I was turned to Craigslist because I needed work, and there was a guy on Craigslist that was looking for somebody to help him with doors. So I reached out to him, and this was early on in the internet marketing and stuff. And this guy, what he would do was he was selling these door jobs and door repair jobs. He was going on Google and advertising on Google through AdWords, PPC, pay-per-click. Mm-hmm. And he was selling me the leads, I would just give him a percentage of the job. I would do it and then just pay him for the lead. And I thought, man, this is really cool. And I did that for a couple of years and did really good, you know. He actually got a DUI and decided that he wanted to do some other stuff. So here I am. I was really enjoying this and really felt that there was a business here if I could figure out myself how to develop these leads and to get this business. So I got a couple books, had a customer that I installed a door for, helped me build a website, and I started teaching myself how to do PPC. I named my company originally DFW Door Repair because that's a search term that someone would search. It says who we are, where we are, and what we do, right?
Right.
And it's very searchable. That's how I came up with that name, because early on, I was trying to get all my leads from online. So I had a little website built. Wasn't much, but it was enough. I waded off into the Google PPC advertising. Back then, in 2008 or 2009, it was relatively easy. And I say easy compared to today, PPC is much more complex and just crazy the amount of things you have to understand to be able to do it effectively. But back then, the whole interface was two or three pages on their website, and it was really cheap. I was paying 15, 25 cents a click for clicks back then. And
what is it now?
Oh, a lot of our clicks are $25 or $30, you know.
Not surprised.
Yeah. So depending on, you know, repairs or less than replacements and stuff. But anyway, it was relatively inexpensive, and it's grown with scale When I spent $500 a month for PPC, I thought that, man, this is a lot of money. There's no way I can afford this. Now we spend $20,000 or $30,000 a month on PPC. So,
holy smokes.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it was working. I had proven to myself and to the marketplace that there was something here that we could turn into a business. And I did that for several years. I did all the installs, I did all the sales, all the things, answered all the calls, made a pretty good living, making $2,000-$4,000 a week and working 3 or 4 days a week. At that point in time in my life, I thought I was going to make it as a professional fisherman, fishing bass tournaments.
Really? That's quite a tangent right there.
Yeah. So I loved it. I could work 2 or 3 days a week, make enough money to take care of my family and pay my bills. And it would give me 2 or 3 days a week to fish and travel and do those things. But it was a really neat time in my life. I had just gotten married. My wife had 3 little boys. Say little, one of them was 16 when we got married. One of them was 3 and one of them was 6, I think. Life was awesome. We were making plenty enough money, had a nice home, all the things. But as all good things do, Google starts changing things. The algorithms change. You don't get enough calls. So we started having to spend more on marketing and all things. So I got to a point in my life to where I felt like I could make enough money to save for a nice retirement and just carry on like we were doing. Or we could turn this into a business, take the chance to retire early, possibly, or to create a nice business to sell or family business, whatever, but bigger opportunities. Mm-hmm. And we decided that we could help more people along the way if we grow the business. So that's kind of the direction we went. And you can only help yourself if you're saving for your own retirement. But if you grow something big enough and get enough people to help you along the way, you can help change their lives too. So we decided that that was the path that we wanted to take and the journey that we wanted to go on. And that's what we did.
And is that the time that you incorporated as your new company? Or
it was. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, 2008 or 9, we having, like I said earlier, good at sales, good at doing the things, but just didn't have everything put together and didn't know that, right? You probably couldn't have told me that back then. Making $6,000-$7,000 a week gross was a big deal. I thought I was, you know, the king. And there's an old proverb that's been twisted, and I'm going to say it in a country way that my dad says it to me today. Is like, the older I get, the smarter my dad was, right? So the older you get, the more you realize that the less you knew. And you should have been listening to these people that were talking to you along the way. So
there is that. There's also the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know.
Correct. The epitome of that is realizing, and sometimes it takes a while, that you don't know anything at all. And there's always the journey of life. If you stop learning, you stop growing and you start dying. You can literally, Colonel Sanders, I don't think fried a piece of chicken until he was in his 60s. Look what they turned that into. Mm-hmm. I was relatively, I don't know, I was probably close to 40 when I realized that I didn't know anything and I had to relearn all this because I grew to hate my business. I grew to hate people that worked for me. I grew to resent the fact that there was never enough money. When you get to a point where you start relying on employees and all the things, there was never enough money. It didn't matter if I made $50,000 this week or $10,000. It was always just enough to make payroll or just enough to get by. There was always something hiding or lurking to where the money was never enough. And it was all because I had no idea what I was doing as a business person. It was all by the seat of my pants. Well, hip pocket accounting. There was money in the checking account. There was money, right? And it was very chaotic. It was, I still in my stomach had these feelings of how that time in life made me feel. It's important to have those things in your life as you grow. Number one, to avoid them. But number two, you got to have these lessons in life to learn and grow and realize that you don't know what you don't know. It was those things that made me start reaching out to people and learning on my own and understanding some of these principles that I never was exposed to. Luckily, it was just before it was too late financially that we were able to learn a lot of these things and principles and turn it around, get things on the right track.
Getting it on track, was that before or after you incorporated?
So I've actually incorporated a couple different times. when I incorporated the first time, I had no idea what I was doing. At that time, we did it all online. The state of Texas, you go and you incorporate, you go on the IRS website and get your EIN and all things. Well, I didn't know that you had to do a franchise filing and all these things annually, or franchise at the state level. The way they make you do it, you have, at that point in time, you had to renew it. And I didn't realize that that was a thing or that I had to do it, and it expired. So a couple of years later, when we were trying to do something, you know, under the business name, buy a truck or something, I don't remember what it was. They said, well, your franchise filing at the state of Texas is no longer effective and hasn't been for a few years. So I started trying to unravel all that. And they were like, well, now your business is too, the name of your business is too similar to the name of another business. You have to get them to agree to let you use this name or you can't use it. And I'm like, well, at the time when I got it before, it was fine. And it never came up. Well, the rules had changed on naming businesses since then. So we went that route. We tried to get them to let us use the name. They didn't want to do it. We wound up actually getting some guidance and reincorporating as a holding company using DBAs to an S corp to an LLC to reorganize and you know, get things kind of off on the right foot, which it needed to be done anyway, but at the time I didn't know it. So that was in 2008 when we got started. We got everything kind of finally on the right track, probably in 2013 or 14. After all that, what's weird is I really didn't start taking business growth and development serious until 2018 or 19. It took 10 years for me to start doing that. You know, I was just always out chasing money. And I'm sure you talk to a lot of guys, and if you've been in the home improvement business very long, you see a lot of guys go under, or you see people in all these groups, these neighborhood groups, you know, they have the contractors, they show up, they draw up some money, they get started, they do some work, they draw up some more money, and they never hear from them. Mm-hmm. A lot of times that is not because those contractors are bad people, but it's because they are perpetually tangled up in the money train, right? They don't know how to charge the right price for their work. They don't know how to bid the jobs. They don't know how to manage the jobs. And the only thing they know how to do is sell and get started. They never know how to finish things. And what happens is they wind up perpetually chasing the next job to pay for the last job, and they run out of money. They run out of other people's money. It's a vicious cycle that I see all the time. It happened to me. We hired a pool contractor that was caught up in this, and luckily we got almost 80 or 90% done before the wheels fell off. So it wasn't that bad, but there was a lot of people in our community that were affected by this contractor, you know, that had paid large 70, 60% deposits on these projects and didn't get anything. So In the state of Texas, you don't necessarily have to have a contractor's license to do remodeling or general repairs, or even to build a house. You have to have a contractor's license to be a plumber, a heat and air, or electrician. There's a couple other things, but generally speaking, general home repair, general remodeling, general contracting, you don't need a license. So the barrier of entry is pretty low. Contractors, they call those chuck in a truck, right? A guy shows up, says he can do it. And homeowners are always seem to be lured in by the much lower prices of these guys that can do it. And a lot of times they'll get away with it. And a lot of these guys are good people and know how to do a good job. But what happens, though, is the homeowner will get a hold of one of these guys is at the lower end of the drain, circling the drain, and they'll get taken for thousands of dollars. And like I said, not necessarily because the guy's maybe a crook or a bad guy, but just because they don't know how to do business. They don't know their numbers. I had to fall back to the basis of business and learn how to do all these things and rebuild my business up from the ground up to understand these things myself. And I did, looking back in retrospect, after I started to gain knowledge on these things, I'm like, holy cow, how did I ever survive to get to this point? Like running the gauntlet. There's so many things, regulations and things that you have to get through anyway, just to have that 5% chance to make it in business. But you also have to outlive yourself if you don't have the business experience and knowledge that it would take to run a successful business, or at least a profitable one.
What was the genesis of your transition into getting squared away?
That's a pretty big question. About 5 years ago, I started listening to podcasts, right? I just felt like there was so much time of the day. We all just get in the car and listen to the radio on the way to work, or we listen to talk radio or sports radio or whatever while we're working if we have that type of job, right? And I had found this podcast. I mean, I've had an iPhone since probably 2015 or 16, I guess, maybe even longer, 2012. And there's a button on your phone, and I never knew what it was. It's a little, oh, if you have an iPhone, it's a little purple app, and it's for podcasts. And one day I just decided to click on that to see what that was. And of course, when you do that, you're overwhelmed with all these things to choose from. So I found this podcast by a guy. It was, the guy's name was Brian Buffini. He was a real estate guy, but he always had just general things on there, like motivational stuff. And I heard he had a podcast with Lou Holtz. And Lou Holtz is a legendary college football coach from South Carolina. He coached at Arkansas, and he's always really good at delivering motivational stuff. So I heard Lou Holtz on there, and I was like, man, that kind of fired me up. And then I started looking into other stuff. And then Les Brown is another guy. That guy fired me up. And I started getting more and more motivated to start listening to things that were a little bit more business related and related to me more specifically than just general motivation. One day I stumbled across Tommy Mello's podcast, and Tommy Mello, for the people listening that aren't aware of him, he runs a well over $200 million a year now garage door company. They're in several markets across the United States, but they're based out of Phoenix. And Tommy started just like a lot of us do, not knowing business, not knowing how to do all these things, in debt, and just a lot of issues that a lot of younger or immature business owners, and I say immature, I mean not a lot of time under their belt in running a business or business sense. And he basically has this podcast on his journey along the way over the years. And I think he started his podcast, you know, 7 or 8 years ago.
It's been a while.
Yeah. I know, as crazy as it sounds, that you can learn how to run a business by listening to podcasts. But
you just listened to part one of an excellent conversation with Billy Klein. The conversation was a bit over 2 hours, so I've broken the episode into 3 parts. Coming soon will be part 2, followed soon after by part 3. I appreciate you and hope you enjoy part 2 and 3 as well. Give Billy some love and share this episode with others. This episode's trivia question is, where does the Mississippi River begin? Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Blue Collar Voices Show. On this episode's page on bluecollarvoices.com, you will find show notes and any relevant links. If you are not subscribed to get notifications of new show episodes, you can do that at bluecollarvoices.com as well. Hey, let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.
I'll be back.